From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Bob Garfield is out this week. I'm Mike Pesca.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. More kidnappings, more killings this week in Iraq, but the skirmishes that received the most coverage were on Capitol Hill. Emboldened by last week's overwhelming rejection of an amendment sponsored by John Kerry, calling for a timetable for a pullout from Iraq, Republicans went on the offensive, deriding Democrats for defeatism and disunity. On Thursday, the Senate soundly defeated two other proposals for troop withdrawal, and through it all, one phrase anchored the Republican message.
When it gets difficult, they fall back on that party's old pattern of cutting and running.
And they're advocating a policy called cut and run.
We can't just sit here and wave the white flag that we can't cut and run.
By the way, I just want to know whether Senator Frist has any other words that he knows but cut and run.
It's probably safe to say that not since the 1700s, when cut and run was coined as a command for sailors to slash the anchor line and run a ship before the wind, has the phrase been invoked so often. And its ubiquity prompted Washington Post columnist Dana Milbank to file a piece for Wednesday's paper headlined, "It's Time to Cut and Run from Cut and Run."
The Democrats have tried to come up with a slogan that would be equally compelling. John Kerry tried lie and die. It didn't work out quite as well.
John Murtha, in an interview with Tim Russert, called the Republicans' position stay and pay. Do you think any of these are going to work?
Not necessarily. The last attempt I saw by the Democrats was, they said, the Republican strategy on Iraq was the title of their email. Then you opened the email and there was nothing in it. So that one doesn't translate quite as well. They might be able to counter with some slogan of their own, but they haven't been able to agree on one. So it's very hard, I think, for an American to picture what is the opposition's view on Iraq without thinking of cut and run. We, the reporters up there on Capitol Hill, when we're talking to the Democratic staffers, always saying, so the Kerry cut and run proposal comes before the Carl Levin cut and run proposal. It's just become part of the lexicon.
Some political analysts have said that Republicans have already won the war of slogans because the Democrats are defending themselves against it.
This amendment is not cut and run. This is about getting the president to do the job correctly.
General Casey today suggested that we could withdraw troops, and I don't think anyone is going to label him as cutting and running.
They're going to try to make the elections in November a choice between cut and run and stay the course. That's not the choice. My plan is not cut and run.
Once a Democrat says this isn't about cutting and running, then the Republicans have framed the debate and already won it.
I think you're right, and I think the same thing was true in the immigration debate when all they kept saying was amnesty, amnesty, amnesty. Those in support of the Senate plan were saying, this isn't amnesty, this isn't amnesty. Once one side has defined debate in one of these pithy phrases, if you are working on the other side's words, you're fighting on their turf.
Well, if you cast your mind back to past slogans and past election seasons, can you think of other good, sticky slogans that effectively reduced a nuanced position to a pithy, pejorative slam?
Tax and spend, amnesty, cut and run. The whole question is, how do you put it on a bumper sticker? You know, the classic was save Social Security first. This is what Clinton came up with, and it effectively did change the whole national debate in the 1990s about tax cuts and retiring the deficit. He won that whole debate in large part because of a slogan.
Media critic Eric Bollert wrote on the Huffington Post this week that the media actually are the problem because they've rushed to the judgment that the Republicans have the Democrats on the run with this slogan strategy. He quotes several polls showing that a majority of voters actually favor a pullout strategy and that they would, in fact, support candidates who agree with them. So have we actually gotten ahead of ourselves here, Dana, by declaring the Republicans the winner so far?
Well, you know, politics is about having one good day followed by another, then soon you've had a good week. And I think the failure of the Democrats to have these cut-and-run amendments get through really caused their position to deteriorate, which becomes the story for a day or two. Now, you add up a few things like that, and you know, that will influence coverage, that will influence how the public is viewing the war. But there's any number of other things you've got to weigh against that. You know, the finding of the two mutilated U.S. servicemen, obviously that would weigh against the Republican view that we should keep on doing exactly what we're doing there.
It sounds like what you're saying is that what really matters are votes and events on the ground, and that perhaps this whole slogan discussion is irrelevant. I hope you don't think so, because then we have to find another lead for the program this week.
Slogans are terrific. But anything that Congress can do right now is background noise. They could, in theory, defund the war in Iraq and bring it to an end right now. Everybody knows that's not going to happen. So the entire debate in the Congress is all about background noise. It has nothing to do with the actual pursuing of the war in Iraq.
All right, Dana, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Dana Milbank is a political columnist for The Washington Post.
When presidential speechwriter Michael Gerson announced that he was leaving the White House last week, the administration lost the man who did the most to fill the president's famous eloquence gap. From announcing the then Texas governor's presidential aspirations to coining Axis of Evil and hundreds of policy statements in between, Gerson wrote the words that made the whole world listen. New Yorker writer Jeffrey Goldberg profiled Gerson last February, and Jeffrey joins us now. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So to best understand Michael Gerson, I think we have to hear his words, and this is George W. Bush delivering them at the second inaugural.
All who live in tyranny and hopelessness can know the United States will not ignore your oppression or excuse your oppressors. When you stand for your liberty, we will stand with you.
Jeffrey, what to you stands out about that speech?
The sheer eloquence of it. It's the summation of the president's best instincts and the ideology that he has adopted. You could trace a line back all the way to Wilson through Roosevelt and Truman and to Reagan. And this is his adoption of that core idea. And the thing about it that always struck me was you have a fairly inarticulate president speaking these beautiful sentences, just beautiful sentences, really they are. So I became intensely curious about the guy who was writing those sentences, who I think is really considered one of the best speechwriters of the last 45 years or so.
And is he one of the best speechwriters because what he has to work with in terms of the, let's be charitable, plain-spoken president isn't like Theodore Sorensen working with JFK, who could at the drop of a hat just be eloquent?
That's a very interesting question. With Sorensen and Kennedy, you had an eloquent, Harvard-educated president having on his staff a very eloquent speechwriter. Here you have a guy who must translate, in essence, a somewhat inarticulate president's thoughts into rhetoric. So that's where people in Washington became so impressed with Gerson.
I know from reports that George W. Bush does redline speeches and say things like, well, I wouldn't say this and this isn't me. He seems to give Gerson much more latitude than he does anyone else who tries to put words in his mouth.
It's one of the strangest editor-writer relationships in the world. The speechwriter is the guy who sits in the basement and draws pictures of what his president should be. People always talk in the White House of a mind meld between George Bush and Michael Gerson. And I think that existed because both men think in these sweeping moral terms of freedom and of the transformative powers of American force to make the world a better place. Both are committed Christians. They were also, by the way, in harmony on issues of race and racial justice. I mean, the best speech in my mind that Gerson ever wrote was the speech that Bush delivered at Gori Island, former slave trading station in Senegal. It deals with American guilt and the redemptive powers of American democracy to fix what was wrong.
Christian men and women became blind to the clearest commands of their faith and added hypocrisy to injustice. A republic founded on equality for all became a prison for millions. And yet, in the words of the African proverb, no fist is big enough to hide the sky.
There are people on the left and even in the center who would say that Bush might not be personally racist, but he can't be considered a friend of African Americans. But you look at the speech, and it, as a speech, it's flawless.
That speech in Senegal, that was an instance where the words really mattered a lot. In fact, there wasn't too much policy behind it. There wasn't supposed to be. It was the equivalent of a wreath-laying ceremony.
Exactly.
To go back to the second inauguration.
When you stand for your liberty, we will stand with you.
Now, if I live in Burma, or if I live in Darfur, and the United States drags its feet, I could look back on that speech and say, you lied. Maybe Gerson, in trying to establish this soaring rhetoric, soared too far.
That's an interesting question, and we actually talked about this. And he said, what's the choice? We're not going to tell the people of the world that sometimes we're going to be on your side when it's convenient, and we believe in freedom in a sort of contingent way. That doesn't make a speech. But you hit on something that's incredibly serious, which is the issue of fecklessness. Sharansky speaks of 25 years ago, hearing of President Reagan describe the Soviet Union as an evil empire, and Sharansky sitting in the gulag and everybody becoming electrified by this because they felt that finally an American president really understood what was going on. So you're right. You've got to be careful with this because we're an extraordinarily powerful country. And it's a reminder, by the way, of George Bush 41, who right after the first Gulf War called for the uprising of the Kurds and the Shiites, only to pull out his support for that uprising in Iraq.
Do you think the words themselves have ever changed the policies?
Oh, I think so, yeah. I know this from conversations inside the White House, that there have been times when people have gone to the president and said, you've said this, we've got to try here to match the rhetoric a little bit more. On AIDS, and this is an example where Gerson said in very stark terms in meetings with the president, we will not be forgiven if we don't do more.
And finally, I don't know who's going to replace Gerson, if anyone can, but do you want to see the next person inspire George Bush to great flights of rhetoric? Or is after 6 years, in your opinion, is the time for that come and gone, and maybe we could spend the last 2 years with more straight talk?
There's nothing wrong with great rhetoric that calls out our better angels. What you'd hope for, Katrina might be the perfect example, is if it's a choice between beautiful rhetoric and building some levees, you'd rather see the levees built.
Well, Jeffrey Goldberg, with the wind at your back, this interview has certainly taken flight, and for that I thank you.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Goldberg is the Washington correspondent for The New Yorker magazine.
Every time the people of this land have come back from fire, flood, and storm to build anew, and to build better than what we had before. Americans have never left our destiny to the whims of nature, and we will not start now.
Coming up, NPR's in-house critic is leaving the building, and in Saudi Arabia, young women log in and lift the veil a little.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Mike Pesca. More than 6 years ago, long before the misdeeds of Jason Blair prompted the New York Times to hire a public editor, Jeffrey Dvorkin filled that role as ombudsman for NPR, responding to listener complaints and adding quite a few of his own. This program has had some beefs over the years with his beefs, and as a reporter for NPR, yeah, I have too. Jeffrey left Monday to direct the Committee of Concerned Journalists, and I grabbed him as he walked out the door. Hey, Jeffrey, welcome back to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
Want to talk about a few stories that you weighed in on over the years. And you know how this goes. I'm not bringing these up to pat you on the back saying, huzzah, sir. So one is a report on the so-called BTK killer, Dennis Rader, who was sentenced as a serial killer in Wichita, Kansas. The NPR reporter aired segments of Dennis Rader, not the entire statements, but segments of Dennis Rader making his statement in court. And some of these segments were kind of graphic. Listeners wrote to you and they complained that this was a bit too graphic and not what they expect on NPR, and you agreed. So my question is, even though the crimes that he committed and the way he described it might be very discomforting, isn't it news? And why shy away from that?
Well, because I think that crime reporting is only necessary when it says something about our society. So I think we need to take a step back on this. The other thing is that crime has declined in the United States by something like 5% over the last 35, 36 years. Crime reporting in American media has gone up something like 1,000%. It may sell more newspapers, but I don't think it's valuable journalism for public radio.
In your column, you said that our reporting on the BTK killer was necessary. It was one of the biggest, if not the biggest, national story at the time. Your objection was to his actual statements in court.
Right. I think it was a story worth reporting, but I don't think the audio was worth broadcasting.
I know that there is a lurid, and the word you used was prurient, aspect to that, but the words of the killer aren't an important, if deeply disturbing, part of the story?
Right.
Okay. That's called straightforward. Another interview that you talked about was Scott Simon's interview with John Waters, the filmmaker who basically is a connoisseur of trash and bad taste. And in his interview, he didn't say any of the seven dirty words, but he did use turd and refer to a dog humping. And you said that you agree with the listener's complaints that John Waters may be droll for a lot of people, but by using naughty words for their shock value, this is not always a good reason to put him on the radio, at least on NPR. Could it be that you just don't get John Waters?
It certainly sounds like I'm a bit of a prude on these things, but I also think that the audience has a different value to what they hear on NPR at different times of the day. There are more children around the radio in the morning than there are in the afternoon. And so Weekend Edition Saturday should have said, you know what, Weekend, all things considered, you should have this.
In your defense, as far as the issue of if you're a bit of a prude, I do want to point out that you did weigh in at one point about the word fart being used in an interview with a children's author, and you said that you thought the listeners of NPR could handle the word fart.
There are people who are sensitive to particular issues. I think NPR has to do a better job in anticipating how certain things will be heard. This week on Morning Edition, there was someone who commented on the fact that there is no Tooth Fairy and there is no Easter Bunny.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a call from a lady in upstate New York who said that her children, who were 4 and 5, were listening to Morning Edition and they heard this and they burst into tears. You know, I felt terrible. I mean, and I felt that, you know, maybe NPR should have been more aware that there are consequences to what they are doing and when they are putting it on the radio, and they need to be more aware of that.
There's no Easter Bunny. Maybe we should have attributed it to a source close to the Easter Bunny, and then we take that step away.
Exactly.
The biggest story that you ever weighed in terms of getting your name bandied about there must have been when Terry Gross, host of Fresh Air, interviewed Bill O'Reilly, and Bill O'Reilly was so offended he got up and left.
I got 4,000 emails on that. I think she is fantastic. And I think the problem with the interview that she did with Bill O'Reilly, and I heard from a lot of public radio listeners on this as opposed to O'Reilly Nicks on this, was that she seemed to be going after him in a way that was unfair. The biggest problem I had with it was that when O'Reilly walked out of the studio in New York and Terry was in Philadelphia and she said, Bill O'Reilly, are you still there? And he was gone. Then she continued to attack him by reading a criticism from People magazine, of all places. And that's called the empty chair interview. And it is unethical and unfair.
I listened to that interview, and my takeaway from that was right before Bill O'Reilly walked out, Terry was attempting to read a quote from People magazine. Bill said, don't read that. Terry wanted to read that. Then Bill walked, or perhaps staged his walkout. At that point, if I were doing the interview, I'd have read it because I'd have said to myself, well, he doesn't get the right to censor me or say what I could say on my show. And I, as a listener, very much wanted to hear what that quote was from People magazine because that was the entire thing that preceded the walkout. So that was my takeaway on that.
Well, as they say, you have the right to your opinion.
So, Jeffrey, you're moving on to become the executive director of the Committee of Concerned Journalists, but I want to ask you about your replacement. Is there something that the next NPR ombudsman could bring to the job that you didn't or couldn't for whatever reason?
I could always have been more patient. I think that when people call up with steam coming out of their ears, the best way to approach them is to listen to what they have to say. So I think that if I were to do this job again, I would work on trying to be more of an advocate for their concerns, even if they are fairly insulting.
The longest conversation I've had with you is this today, but you don't seem like a particularly hot-headed guy. Heck, you're Canadian.
Not anymore. I'm a U.S. citizen now, so I can be just as hot-headed as you, Mike.
Jeffrey DeVork, an outgoing ombudsman in more ways than one for National Public Radio. Thanks very much for talking with me today.
My pleasure.
On Monday, the United Nations inaugurated its new Human Rights Council, a 47-member body that replaces the discredited Human Rights Commission. The group Reporters Without Borders swiftly expressed concern about some of the council's member states, including Saudi Arabia, where it said, censorship is the rule. Joel Campagna is the Mideast Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. Last month, he released a report about press freedom in Saudi Arabia after making two trips to the kingdom and speaking with more than 80 members of the Saudi press. Now, back before the first Gulf War, the Saudi press made news by failing to report Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait. Campagna says the press has loosened up a little since then because of what happened after September 11th, 2001.
Mainly the pressure internationally on Saudi Arabia to reform. The idea that the lack of liberties in Saudi Arabia had helped the country become a hotbed for extremism. This led to a lot of internal reflection efforts towards reform. And I think the first place where we saw attempts at opening was in the Saudi press, where we saw this slight liberalization, where the press was tackling subjects that were previously off limits just a few years earlier, like crime, unemployment, the security forces' battles with religious extremists.
In March of 2002, 15 students, girls, were killed in a school fire, and you called this a watershed moment for the press, too. How come?
Allegations that the country's feared religious police had actually prevented girls from leaving the premises because they didn't have the proper headscarves on, and that had led to the unnecessary deaths of several girls. Those allegations were printed by Saudi newspapers, really breaking a taboo. So for a time being, there was this unprecedented debate about the role of the religious police.
And now the third trigger in 2003, suicide attacks in Riyadh. What was the press reaction then?
We saw probing articles about how religious sheikhs were purveying extremist ideologies openly in the kingdom. And we had columnists warning of the potential dangers that that posed to Saudi security. Some of the most daring Saudi publications were questioning some of the religious underpinnings of the Wahhabi brand of Islam that prevails in Saudi Arabia and talking about teachings that militants have exploited to condone acts of violence. When you look at Saudi society, really explosive issues that were being tackled.
So here you have an example of three triggers, three efforts at liberalization. But as your report points out, none of those triggers actually created a permanent change.
Every time we saw the press exhibiting more daring in their coverage, the state would push back by banning writers and sacking editors. We saw, as we mentioned earlier, the case after the suicide bombings in Riyadh. Al-Watan newspaper, which is known for its liberal bent, had published editorials that were critical of Wahhabism. Well, a couple weeks after those articles ran, the paper's editor was sacked under pressure from the government and by order of, at that time, Crown Prince Abdullah. And I think the best way to describe Saudi press freedoms after September 11th is to use the words of a liberal Saudi academic who I spoke with. He said, the margin of freedom in the press in Saudi Arabia is one that is given and taken away.
Now, as you lay it out in your report, there are three forces at work in suppressing news coverage in Saudi Arabia: government officials who dismiss editors, suspend and blacklist dissident writers in order to appease that other force that's working against the media, which are the conservative clerics. And then, of course, you have a compliant government-approved media. That pretty much sums it up, right?
Indeed.
Sounds like a closed circle to me.
That's true. Saudi editors of the leading publications are approved by the government. If you are an editor of a leading paper, you must get the assenting nod of the information minister as well as the interior minister. So essentially, Saudi editors are loyalists of the royal family.
So it sounds as if you want to tap into what Saudi Arabians are thinking outside of what is permitted, then you have to go online.
When you look at the internet, or when you look at what Saudis are saying on satellite television, on blogs, or even in their own homes, the debate is open, it's lively, but unfortunately, much of that is not happening or is not written about or talked about in the Saudi press.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joel Campagna is with the Committee to Protect Journalists. We'll link to his report on Saudi Arabia from our site on themedia.org. Rashid Abu Al-Sam knows a lot about the lively debate happening online in Saudi Arabia. He writes a blog there in which his views often clash with that of his main employer, the conservative Arab News. He also writes for foreign papers like the Washington Times and the Christian Science Monitor. In a recent Monitor piece, he profiled some notable blogs written by young Saudi women. He told us that one of those bloggers, who goes by the name Saudi Eve, returned from a business trip to find her website blocked.
She's been writing a lot about her love life and a bit about her sex life, though not anything explicit in Western terms, and also writing about God and spirituality and religion. And she's mixed the two together. And I think the fact that she did write about religion and sex in the same post in Arabic attracted lots of negative attention from the authorities, and I think that's what caused her to be blocked.
Has she gotten any support within Saudi Arabia?
Yes, I would say it's split 50-50. Other bloggers were outraged when she was blocked, and they started an Unblock Saudi Eve campaign on their site, and they also encouraged other bloggers to send Unblock request forms to the King Abdulaziz City for Science and Technology, which is the main internet hub for the kingdom.
So you're saying the reaction to Saudi Eve's plight is about 50-50. What about the ones who are against her?
I read lots of comments from female bloggers that were telling her, oh, you know, we really think what you've been writing is horrible and you shouldn't be exposing your private life in public. I was able to read those things because I have a satellite internet connection, which gets me past the censors. And I think many Saudis are subscribing to this new form of technology to get around the censorship.
And how long will that last before that route is also blocked?
Well, it's pretty expensive. It costs more than $100 a month to subscribe to it. So I don't think they fear that a mass population would take it up anytime soon.
Now, some bloggers have organized under something called the Official Community of Saudi Arabian Bloggers. You'd think they'd be supportive of Saudi Eve, but in fact, they're not, right?
The opposite, in fact. I interviewed one of the founders of the Official Community of Saudi Arabian Bloggers, and his name is Mohammed Masayed. He was saying that their group aims to support bloggers who mostly write in Arabic, that they exclude blogs that are purely like personal diaries, and they exclude blogs that criticize Islam in any way. So I'm sure they construed what she had written on her blog as being criticism of Islam or not being appropriate to what they think religious topics should be talked about.
So they profess great conservatism and respect for the faith, but there was a post that we found from another young Saudi woman's blog, a site called A Thought in the Kingdom of Lunacy. This woman's email moniker is Classic Diva, and here's what she wrote after talking to one of the bloggers from the official community of Saudi Arabian bloggers. She writes, "We chatted a few times, and one day he told me that his father was in the hospital terminally ill, and within a few minutes of him telling me about his father, he tried to have cyber sex with me. What I want to know is this. What is someone like that doing as a member of OXAB?" She writes, "And while I'm on the subject of Islamic principles, since when are covert relationships permissible in Islam? Is she likely to incur any risk for even writing a blog entry like that?"
Well, as I wrote in my story, she has many problems with her own family being able to blog, because she told me that her family is very conservative and that for a few months they forbade her to use the internet at home because her brothers were suspicious that she was having an online affair with somebody. I mean, she was forced to sneak out of the house to go, you know, use the internet at her friend's house to blog.
Or, as you mentioned in your piece, the universal refuge for bloggers, Starbucks.
Yes, exactly, where you have wireless internet access.
Many great claims have been made for the power of the internet to liberalize countries. They used to say it about China. People don't say it so often anymore. Do you think the internet can have an impact on the culture of Saudi Arabia?
Yes, I do, definitely. I mean, we currently have a population of around 24 million people in Saudi Arabia. 3.1 million of them are currently online. And according to a study that came out this week from Microsoft, there's a 20% internet growth rate in the kingdom. So, I mean, although there are only like 300 blogs registered in the kingdom that I know of, I do think that the internet is having an impact.
Rashid, obviously you feel pretty comfortable in departing from the editorial line of your newspaper in your pieces in the Christian Science Monitor, the Washington Times, and in your conversations with us. Are you feeling pretty secure at Arab News, or do you just feel you have other places to go?
I do feel secure because I know there are many other Saudis who think the same way I do, but they're just too afraid to speak up.
Why aren't you?
Because I think in the end, I think we Saudis have to decide what sort of country we want for the future. We just have to come out and, you know, speak up for what we believe in.
All right. Rashid, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rashid Abu Al-Sam is a senior editor at Arab News, and he blogs at rashidsworld.blogspot.com.
Coming up, the media rush to judgment in Durham, and we bid farewell to Dan Rather. Again.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Mike Pesca. On the night of March 13, 2006, inside a house right off the campus of Duke University in Durham, North Carolina, a stripper danced for some players on the Duke lacrosse team and then claimed she was raped. We don't know what really happened. It's almost too obvious to say. Of course we don't know what happened. That's why there is a question, a controversy, and a community divided. But even though we don't know, the media quickly developed some strong presumptions. This is local station WRAL, prosecutorial CNN hostess Nancy Grace, and CBS News early on informing us that things seem pretty dire for the players.
Duke's lacrosse team players appear to be giving police the silent treatment about the allegations of gang rape.
I know that there are witnesses that are ultimately going to come forward and name the three men in the bathroom with this girl.
But investigators are convinced the attack happened and frustrated by the team's wall of silence.
Cash Michaels is editor and chief reporter for the Carolinian newspaper in Raleigh and staff writer for the Wilmington Journal. A member of the Black Press, he sees his role as part journalist and part activist, demanding justice for his people. Early on, Michael says, the broader media were also concentrating on the demands for justice.
Most of that initial coverage was driven by the protests and demonstrations of the Duke students themselves, who marched on campus, who marched to the address 610 North Buchanan Boulevard, where the alleged assault occurred. They demanded some response from the administration. They were demanding that the lacrosse team players themselves step forward. So their activism drove the story initially without question.
Keith Woods, dean of the faculty of Poynter, a media studies institute, says that reporters aren't supposed to take a side, but they're human. And when protesters in Durham were demanding that officials take seriously the allegation of white men gang raping a black woman, it struck a journalistic nerve.
Is there a bias toward believing a woman when she says she's raped? Yes, absolutely. So if you had to begin with a bias on one side or the other, you're generally going to begin with the bias toward the person who is at the bottom. We are just a little bit more comfortable being wrong if that's the way we will be wrong.
The big newspapers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Philadelphia Inquirer among them, sought to provide context, meaning stories about the racial makeup of the city of Durham compared with the university, and the tension between town and gown, as they say. We were told, in Time magazine's words, of the air of privilege surrounding Duke's lacrosse team.
If there is an air of privilege at Duke, and you can prove that with facts and details, you can do a story about that.
Poynter's Keith Woods.
The problem is that those things become shorthand for something else. Because as long as you leave it open to interpretation when you say air of privilege, that you might be saying these guys therefore are guilty, then the flaw is there.
Perhaps, as many have suggested, there is a bigger story, an opportunity to converse about race, gender, class, and privilege. That sentiment prevailed in the initial media coverage. What with a team full of hooligans who urinated in public, who shouted racial slurs at a black stripper they hired, and the DA, Mike Nifeng, who said he had no doubt there was a rape. But after Nifeng got his indictment and, by the way, won a close primary election, he stopped giving interviews. We learned there was no DNA evidence, and quickly the alleged victim's background began to be scrutinized. Soon enough, the media started shooting at the opposite goal.
The evidence really doesn't look like it's adding up. It may be even a question, did it happen at all?
According to the medical records that NBC has looked at, there is little, if no, physical evidence that this woman was brutally raped and beaten by the three Duke lacrosse players.
Mr. Nifeng, tell us what your smoking gun is. Tell us what your evidence is. What are you going forward with here?
Two MSNBC reports, followed by Fox's Andrew Napolitano, questioning, no one in particular, the DA had gone mute. So why the sudden change in coverage? Keith Woods of Poynter says that newly emerging facts may have left the media feeling spurned.
The media feeling that it has been led down their own direction reacts sometimes quite vehemently on the other side when new facts emerge.
Sean Gregory authored Time magazine's initial coverage of the alleged rape story, headlined Fraternity of Silence. It had only two problems. One is that the lacrosse players weren't a fraternity, and the second is that they had the right to remain silent. The story evoked recalcitrant cops accused of abusing their power. The team, quote, formed a blue line of sorts and stayed mum.
First week headline was, oh my God, this event has ripped this campus apart.
Whereas the headline now is the prosecutor's case still there?
Gregory still says that the team's silence requires some explaining, though now he thinks that prosecutor Nifong's silence raises questions too. I put it to him, hasn't he noticed that whichever side isn't talking has had to bear the brunt of negative press?
Yeah, I think, you know, the media wants answers.
But in lieu of answers, we, what, indicate that there might be guilt going on?
You note the silence. You know, what struck us was if these guys were as innocent as they say and might prove to be, you know, where were the parents outraged? Where were the kids? They could have gone crazy with denials. And, you know, all you can do is report that silence and wonder about it.
From the start, the stories in Time's chief competitor, Newsweek, have been a little different from the rest of the pack. Unlike Time, which relied on stringers to report from Duke, Newsweek's Susanna Meadows returned to her alma mater to cover the alleged rape.
I think a lot of the coverage made assumptions about their guilt, but as we've gone along and as evidence has surfaced, or a lack of evidence, I should say, certainly it does feel that more people are kind of now jumping on this bandwagon of, well, maybe these guys didn't do it.
Newsweek and Meadows are certainly providing the bandwagon with horsepower. Their most recent story, titled Doubts About Duke, relies heavily on information provided by defense lawyers. For instance, one scene has the Duke players readily agreeing to DNA tests. Their lawyer, quote, was struck to see how little hesitation the players showed. A lawyer surprised by his client's cooperation. Not exactly case dismissed. But it is in keeping with Newsweek's overall premise, as expressed in the subhead, quote, the prosecutor insists his rape case is strong. One big problem, the facts thus far. Cash Michaels of the Carolinian and the Wilmington Journal doesn't just object to Meadows' conclusions. He objects to Newsweek's drawing conclusions at all. He finds that most of the reporting on this case is imbued with opinion.
When I see this kind of stuff, I have to ask myself the question, fine, does anyone realize that we're supposed to have a criminal justice system? Or do we care? Do we feel that we are the ones that are going to decide this case before a judge and jury ever sees it? And that scares me.
Of course, it was Michaels who did a fair share of crusading to get the prosecutor to act in the first place. Michaels is eager for the story to become, as he calls it, the next Katrina, a conduit for us to have those uncomfortable conversations about, take your pick, race, class, gender, entitlement, privilege, and even the sociology of lacrosse. A Duke administrator has referred to the case as a teachable moment. But if it's predicated on a rape that didn't occur, what can it really teach us about Duke or rape or race relations in America? We don't know what happened on the night of March 13th. People yearn for news coverage that provides answers, and much of the news media are disturbingly willing to satisfy that desire. What will happen is this. Depending on how the case develops, some news outlets will inevitably claim we got it right. But in reporting this case, right isn't backing the side which is ultimately vindicated. To get it right is to have reported the facts and to have maintained all along that beyond those facts, we just don't know.
Now for a few of your letters. Last week, the editor of the Detroit Free Press explained why he was calling on his reporters to find more minority sources. Drew Rothman of Cleveland, Ohio, wrote in to say that he found that effort to be, quote, totally pointless. If the paper is covering a race-related issue or doing an opinion piece affected by race, I could see the purpose in seeking a representative group of sources. However, if the paper is covering environmental science, as noted in the guest's example, would there be any difference in the information received from a white scientist than a black one? Very unlikely. Including people in something purely because of their skin color is every bit as ridiculous as excluding them because of it.
Ted Hsu of Middlebury, Vermont, wrote in to rebut Franklin Foer's negative assessment of ESPN's soccer commentators. Quote, he honestly cannot have been watching the same World Cup on ESPN the rest of us have.
There have been no baseball or basketball analogies, and the announcers, both the play-by-play teams and the post-game commentators, have been almost entirely experienced soccer experts.
But listener Marshall D. Katzman of Ridgewood, New Jersey, asks himself why he watches the World Cup on the Spanish station and then answers, could it be that they do not clutter up the screen with superfluous logos, baseball scores, player profiles, and other trivia that makes it impossible to see the field of play?
And finally, listener Charles Sumnerian writes in this week to take umbrage at the media snipes directed at departing CBS newsman Dan Rather. Quote, what were the headlines yesterday? Rather departs under cloud of scandal. Dan Rather finally quits having stayed too long. Rather and his cohorts made journalism a force to be reckoned with. They actually told people things that mattered. They were arrogant, even haughty, because the government they went after had shamelessly abused power. Kind of like today. And in order to take on those challenges, you have to be rather fat in the head. You certainly can't accuse the press today of being fat in the head. Submissive would be an apt description. Now that the last giant of the profession has departed, the media can properly return to sniveling for a seat at the table.
Keep those comments coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
That last letter, though rather harsh, does remind us of the tradition Rather represented, that of the intrepid anchor who missed working in the field, and perhaps he missed it too much. But Rather was more than just an heir to a great tradition. He was memorable, to say the least, in his own right. On Tuesday, complaining that the network had given him too little to do after he lost the anchor chair in the wake of some botched reporting on the president's National Guard service, Rather cleared out his desk and left. We said goodbye to Dan last November, but thought we might as well say it again.
This is the CBS Evening News, with Dan Rather reporting from CBS News headquarters in New York.
Good evening. Danger. War. Killer, fraud, CIA, mayhem, crisis, horrible, inflation, military threat, the flaming debris, fatal heart attack.
It would have been tough for anyone to take the mantle from the person once voted most trusted man in America. But though it was hotly contested, Bill Leonard, then head of CBS News, called it for Rather.
I'm delighted to announce that Dan Rather will succeed Walter Cronkite as anchor man and managing editor of the CBS Evening News in early 1981.
I seek to be in the Walter Cronkite mold, in the Ed Murrow mold before him. To the best of my abilities, I want to be an honest broker of information.
Well, let me, I'll just add a word to that. I don't think that with Dan taking over the CBS Evening News, there's any problem of transition.
But despite Cronkite's reassuring words, there may have been a problem or two. At the time, some thought veteran newsman Roger Mudd was the heir apparent, passed over because he wasn't as pretty as Rather. And though Cronkite denies it, there were rumors that Uncle Walter was being rushed into retirement because Rather threatened to switch networks. In that scenario, reminiscent of the film All About Eve, Rather plays a rising star who ruthlessly pushes her mentor out of the way. We don't know about that, but the film's famous quip still works.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
In Dan's case, that night lasted 24 years. He walked off a newscast when it was delayed by a tennis match. He was attacked by a man on Park Avenue who asked, Kenneth, where is the frequency? He briefly ended his newscasts with the word courage, causing waggish competitors like Bryant Gumbel to sign off with Mazel Tov and hot dogs. And if you can't remember those bumps in Rather's road, you have only to cast your mind back to the monumental pothole he drove over last September, that 60 Minutes 2 story about the president's dubious National Guard record, and those equally dubious memos used to back that story up.
Are those documents authentic, as experts consulted by CBS News continue to maintain? Or were they forgeries or recreations? We will keep an open mind, and we will continue to report credible evidence and responsible points of view as we try to answer the questions raised about the authenticity of the documents.
And a week later...
I made a mistake. I didn't dig hard enough, long enough, didn't ask enough of the right questions.
Here was proof positive, or perhaps just the latest in a career-long series of proofs positive, that Dan Rather had a liberal bias. But reporters are people, too, and everyone, with the exception of Jim Lehrer, has some kind of bias. They just try not to let it show. Cronkite rarely did. When he pronounced the Vietnam War unwinnable, the Johnson administration gasped. Despite a few suppressed tears when President Kennedy died, Cronkite was always clear-eyed and steady in the tradition of network newsmen he helped to establish. Dan was different. He let it show. He let everything show. As at the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago.
I know you won't, but don't push me. Take your hands off of me unless you plan to arrest me.
Wait a minute.
Wait a minute. Well, Walters, you can see.
I don't know what's going on, but these are security people apparently around Dan.
And after the Twin Towers fell on September 11th, 2001.
If they could go down to Ground Zero and see the following. See those firemen? Take it for a minute, will you?
He was emotional, excitable, occasionally obnoxious. Even when confronting famously combative presidents like Richard Nixon, he just couldn't put a sock in it.
Thank you, Mr. President. Dan Rather with CBS News. Are you running for something? No, sir, Mr. President, are you?
He didn't like Nixon. We know that. There was hardly anything about Dan Rather we didn't know if we watched regularly, and millions did. He was a bit of a loon, especially on election night. Oh, those Ratherisms.
You'd have to say this thing is as tight as the rusted lug nuts on a 55 Ford.
As he explained to David Letterman.
I grew up around people who talk this way.
Oh, I see. So all of these are you just recall them from your experience?
Yeah, and during the year, if I hear something that I say to myself, you know, that's colorful language, and I think I could use it election night.
I never met anyone who talked like that, but I believe him when he says he did. Rather is believable because he is so raw. The first and only extreme anchor in network news. In a time when journalists are suspected of secretly harboring opinions, Rather, consciously or not, goes with full disclosure. In an era when anchors are processed and poured into a mold like Velveeta, Rather is pungent and runny. He hyped and sentimentalized coverage, but I do not agree with the critics who say that Dan Rather, in all his discombobulated liberalness, compromised the integrity of network news. If anything sinks that once great institution, it won't be leftiness or even craziness. It'll be cowardice. Come to think of it, 18 years ago, when Rather intoned courage at the end of his newscasts, maybe he wasn't talking to us.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Vuolo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Clara Peters and Noah Kuman. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Mike Pesca. Bob Garfield will be back next week.
On the Media is supported by Ciao Bella Gelato, purveyors of all natural gelato and fruit sorbets. Their gelato is handmade with imported Italian ingredients. More at ciaobellagelato.com or 1-800-GELATO-3. Support for On the Media also comes from the Beidel Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. And thanks.